Thanks, Liz. So she introduced me. I don't have to reintroduce myself. But on behalf of the Village Square, I want to welcome everyone to tonight's dinner at the Square, By Any Means Necessary, Rebellion, Tribes, and Moral Outrage. So my tribe actually has a particular saying, okay? My tribe, that's the Jewish tribe, has a particular saying, which is, you cannot complete anything you're really working on, but neither are you given permission to not work on it. And that's actually how I feel about the Village Square right now, is I've been working with Liz in different ways for 12 years, and we're not finished, because clearly we live in a country where the work of the Village Square is not done, but we have to keep doing it. That means all of us have to keep doing it. Very grateful tonight for the sponsorship done by Johnson and Blanton, as well as the Tallahassee Democrat. Our sincere thanks for their support of the Village Square. Because of them, we have them as sponsors for this evening. We also want to thank Fran Doxy of St. John's Lively Cafe for tonight's delicious meal. In fact, Audrey just told me she wants the recipe for the chicken. So if we can get that, that would be... So you know that the Village Square, of course, is a nonprofit organization, and who do we depend on to run our organization? We depend on everybody who is here and far more people to support us. So if you're already a member of the Village Square, we thank you for your generous support, but I'm going to ask you, if you're a $76 member, consider raising your membership level up to the $250 level. If you're not a member, become a $76 member. If you raise your membership level to the $250 level, you get to choose two dinner tickets to any of the other dinner programs of your choice. So that comes as a benefit with raising the membership level. If you want to help us keep moving and keep working, please, please, please start to support or increase your support for the Village Square. Well, now it says here it's supposed to be my pleasure to introduce the facilitator for this evening's program. His name is Bill Maddox. Okay, now, I have a real problem with Bill. No, it's not because I'm a liberal and he works for James Madison. It's because the two of us are in the same fantasy baseball league. And this week, the two of us are actually in a championship match fighting each other to see who's going to win the championship of our league. So it's really hard for me to be kind to Bill while I'm fighting him for this week. But in fact, Bill is a good friend. And so it is my honor to introduce another board member of the Village Square, Bill Maddox. And again, Bill, welcome.
Let me just add to Liz's tribute to Rabbi Jack. We're going to really miss him, and I especially have enjoyed this fantasy baseball league that he invited me to participate in. It's a very fascinating league in that it has a former Obama administration ambassador as well as Marco Rubio's general counsel. So you got the whole span. Last week I had to beat an Anglican priest to advance in the playoffs to face off against a Jewish rabbi. So there's probably a joke in there about a priest, a rabbi, and a rank sinner, but we'll save that for later. We have a great program lined up for you tonight. I think you're really going to enjoy our discussion. And I've got two special guests that I want to introduce who are going to kind of help guide our discussion. First, I want to call up Steve Mills. Many of you, I'm sure, know Steve. He's been a fixture here in our city for some time. He's an award-winning educator who has a PhD from Purdue University in marriage and family therapy, which is actually quite good training, I suspect, for some of the work that he now does in navigating the productive tension between opposing perspectives. So he's been involved for many years, as many of you know, at FSU, as the associate director of their Center for Leadership and Social Change. And he will be one of our panelists tonight. So please join me in welcoming Steve. And next we have John Wood, Jr. John is the media director for an organization called Better Angels that was started several years ago by my friend David Blankenhorn, whom you may remember came and spoke a few years ago to one of our dinners. The following morning, Liz and David and I and Neil Skeen went to breakfast, and in many ways the Better Angels organization was kind of hatched that morning over breakfast, and we'll be hearing from John more about its work in bridging the divides that we deal with here at the Village Square. John has a very, very interesting backstory. He was a registered Democrat who campaigned for Obama in 2008, but went on to become a Republican who ran against, kid you not, Maxine Waters in 2014 for a congressional seat in Los Angeles. He grew up in the middle class suburb of Southern California named or called Culver City, the product of a white father, Republican, Trump supporter, and a black mother, straight out of Compton, who enjoys the incredible distinction. When I told my sister this, she was floored. Enjoys the incredible distinction of being the youngest ever dancer on Soul Train. His family is very, very musical. His grandfather was the founder of Dot Records. His father's a jazz pianist. Mother not only dances, but also is an R&B singer. So I think John's going to have a lot to offer us tonight as well. So please join me in welcoming John. And you've got one there. All right, so just at the outset, what I want to do is to just have you guys give us maybe 2 minutes on how you got involved in the work that you do in bridging partisan divides and trying to bring some sort of semblance of sanity to public discourse and public discussion.
Great. You want me to start us off,
Steve? Ahead.
Okay, good deal. Well, thank you all so much, first of all, for having me here and having me out in Tallahassee. The chance to be able to talk to you guys about a subject which is very important, should be of concern to everybody, I think, in our country, is a privilege for me, and that's the subject of how is it that we create understanding, I think, between people in such a divided time. Steve stole a little bit of my thunder in giving so much of my biography, but I'll tell you guys a little bit of an anecdote from when I was on the campaign trail. So I was campaigning in, you know, Congresswoman Waters' district, which is made up substantially of South Central Los Angeles and Watts and different inner city areas. Part of it includes a suburban portion of LA County where there was a pocket of white Republicans. So I would speak every week. I'd be speaking either to a black church in the inner city or to a white Tea Party group in the South Bay, and I had the same opening line for everybody. At the age of 26, they'd ask, what makes you qualified to represent a district as large and complicated as the California 43rd and as diverse as that? And I'd say, well, I'd say, you know, turns out I've got an interesting background. My mother is a liberal black Democrat from inner city LA. My father is a conservative white Republican from Tennessee. I grew up explaining my father to my mother and my mother to my father, and that's why I think I can represent a lot of you. And so that and the truth is that that's really the long and short of it. I went through a bit of a political journey, as many people in this room have done. Most of my relatives were Democrats, some of them were Republicans. Over the course of time, and after working for the Obama campaign in 2008, I sort of took stock of my own personal political views and decided that on most things I was a little bit to the right of the center divider line, but I never stopped thinking of myself as a person who believed in the idea of hope and change, because to me what that meant was the effort to create a sort of post-racial and post-partisan society, in the sense that we would not allow these labels to determine how we feel about each other as Americans. And so the opportunity to work with Better Angels came up a little while after that, and I've committed myself to that work ever since. So, thank you very much.
Great. All right, Steve, tell us your backstory.
Sure. I want to start out also just saying how much I appreciate this opportunity. I think that just thinking about the way that we choose to wield our influence when the stakes are high is one of the most important things we can think about, and I'm looking forward to seeing where we go with this conversation tonight as we talk about this. So influences relevant to this topic. I think one of the first things is I was born in a Baptist family in a conservative county. Any Baptist or Reformed Baptist in this place? No. I just outed you. A lot of people raising their hand down here. And I think that to some degree, there was a lot that was really beautiful about my upbringing and a lot that I cherish about that foundation, but I really just never could get the sheep and the goats thing. You know, when it came to dividing the sheep and the goats, I just never got that. It seemed to me like those herds were hopelessly entangled. And so I think part of my work in sort of coming into the second part of my life, taking on much more liberal points of view and sort of walking away from that orientation was just bridge work that had to happen all the time sort of in me, right? I think that's also important to know because it means that conservative people with integrity and intelligence have been loving and supporting me for my whole life. And so that's really not a group that I can dehumanize, and it's a group I feel like I understand in a way that's helpful in this conversation. I think the marriage and family therapy thing is important. Bill Doherty, in graduate school, was a marriage and family therapist that was a real hero of mine, and it turns out he is the primary, I think, creator in the way that you facilitate your work.
One of our co-founders at Better Angels.
Yeah, which is really interesting. If I had a specialty in the time that I was practicing, it was working with acrimonious couples. And so I feel like what I've learned in that work was how powerful it is if you can find a story that two people can live in together and trade the two stories they come in that are completely incompatible and different. And so, you know, helping with that kind of narrative work was really impactful for me. And then last is my last 20 years at FSU. I've been at Florida State University for the last 20 years in faculty and administrative roles. The last 10 at the Center for Leadership and Social Change. And at the Center for Leadership and Social Change, I led conversations with students. I was just steeped in conversations with students about their most precious and important identities and how those identities related to their leadership potential and how their identities related to them as social servants and their service to others. And those were some of the most beautiful and painful conversations that I've had in my life. And so I think that work really bent me toward sort of the importance of people finding who they are in relation to the groups that they belong to and the groups that they want to connect with as they move from really not kids but young adults to mature adults. And so just to be clear about that, I was August 9th was my last day at the center. I left the center in love with the people there and in love with the work. I just had a deep sense that it was time to transition to the next thing, which I'm not sure what that is, but that's what I'm doing right now. So, yeah. So that's
me. Well, we're delighted to have you as part of our discussion. So we're all working here in the civility space, trying to encourage greater concern and respect for others who may disagree with us. And in this space, what often happens, and tell me if you see this as well, is that an appeal will be made to be more civil, and people, no one will ever really object to civility on its face, but oftentimes when push comes to shove, and when the stakes are high, and oh, I don't know, maybe a Supreme Court nomination is on the table, people begin to say, wait a minute, I'm all for being nice and polite, but if I'm a true believer, I gotta win. And oftentimes there is greater concern in our day for being on the winning side than for being civil. And so what I'd like for us to do is to ask the question, not who's right or wrong, because we could do that and often do that and talk about the substance of political discussion and difference. What I really want us to do tonight is to critique the effectiveness of different people, different groups in the public square in terms of how effective they're being at advancing their cause and their ideas. So I want you guys to join me in a critique, and I would especially invite you to let this be a time for self-criticism, for criticism of your own kind or for those who agree with you, because I think that might be particularly fruitful. And so let me just start, if I may, with you, John, and ask you to respond or react to this. Quite recently, I read something fascinating that I could not imagine coming out of the lips of Newt Gingrich. But this is what former Speaker Newt Gingrich said recently or wrote recently. He says, the Trump coalition faces a crisis because it is losing educated suburban women. This group is the difference between a majority and a minority for Republicans. This is an especially difficult challenge because much of their unhappiness is based on a repudiation of the president's style, not his policies. Policy and issue-oriented appeals may be inadequate because they currently stipulate that these suburban women, that they are so uncomfortable with the style that they can't even think about the issues. So my question for you is, do you share Gingrich's criticism of style, Trump's style getting in the way of the substance of his achievements? Because many people look at this upcoming midterm election and say, why aren't the Republicans doing better? The economy seems to be doing awfully well. A lot of the things that Trump wanted to do have been accomplished. This ought to be a time, granted it's a midterm election and those often go to the party that lost the last election, but nevertheless, many people are wringing their hands saying, why aren't Republicans doing better? Do you share Gingrich's concern about Trump's style?
My Republican friends are really going to be excited when they hear I accepted an invitation to an event where the idea was I'd come out and bash Republicans a little bit. Well, hopefully I get to stay in the club by the time we're done here today. I do agree. It's pretty evident to me that the way we've come to communicate, speaking specifically as a Republican, although there's obviously the broader issue of the decline in civility generally, but I feel like we've come to a bit of a point of culmination in terms of the tone of our political communication. Because over the course of the last, 30 or so years, more or less, really accelerating with Gingrich as a member of Congress, but also as a result of changes in the media landscape, the multiplication of talk radio shows and cable news channels, and obviously Fox in particular and so forth, which I think you can argue provided something of a diversity of opinions and a voice for conservatives who didn't feel as if they had a voice in the mainstream media prior to that. But nevertheless, we've been setting a tone for a while now that says that it is okay for us in the course of marketing our political points of view to tap into the most sort of vitriolic angst within our natures and within our dispositions. And there's a lot of advantage that comes to tapping into those forces of human nature for media networks, for individual politicians. And then you place all of that against the backdrop of a broader sort of cultural, societal, media marketplace where we have reality television, we have so many forms of entertainment that are based off of our essentially fighting with and humiliating each other. And all of this, I think, more or less created the necessary conditions for the perfect storm in which we would have a president whom, whether you agree or disagree with his policies, and I tend to be more conservative. I can certainly point to things he's done on a policy level that I think have been okay. But it was a perfect storm that gave us the true reality TV show president. And what that means is that we've thrown, certainly among Republicans, we've thrown caution to the wind in terms of our willingness to exercise restraint in terms of how we speak to and about one another as fellow Americans, and that's a tremendous threat to the health of our civic culture moving forward.
Let me stop you here and jump in just a quick minute and get Steve in on this, because I'd be interested in hearing whether you think part of the problem here is the tendency for both sides, seemingly every election, to run basically a base election strategy that says, our goal is to mobilize people who already think like us, to get as many of them to turn out as possible, and if we can get 50 plus one, we win. Rather than, it was very common in my youth, when I was watching your mother on Soul Train, it was very common for, and more recently.
Mom's going to love hearing about this.
my sister made me watch it. It was very common, I mean, even much more recently than that, for election times to be cases where, yeah, you might run to capture your base during the primary season, but the general election was a fight over the middle and an attempt to try to win over persuadable folks who weren't yet completely with you. That seems to be completely lost and gone, not just in our election seasons, but in our public discourse and debate. Is that a fair sizing up of the situation? And is part of the problem here that kind of reality show mentality where, you know, when Trump was being a reality show star, you didn't have to win over the masses. You could have a very highly rated show with a kind of niche market that was far less than the overall population. So give me your sense of, is this base election phenomenon part of the problem? Should we be spending more time trying to win over others? Or does it make sense for us to simply mobilize those that are already inclined to agree with us?
I mean, I think the most interesting thing that I'm hearing you talk about here is just the visceral reaction that women are having to Trump, so that they don't even get to the policy. They don't get to anything beyond just this repugnance. And I think a lot of people are like that with Trump. I mean, I think the presidency will never be the same. I think that Trump is sort of deeply narcissistic, that we're almost saturated to some extent with sort of revulsion for him as a figurehead, as a person. I think some people felt one of the primary tenets of social psychology is that intuition comes first and reasoning comes second. So we have a sort of a base visceral reaction, and then we sort of come up with reasons for that reaction. I think some people had a similar reaction to Hillary. A lot of folks sort of held their nose and voted for Hillary because she, you know, the reasoning kicked in, but they had that same feeling. Some of that was sexism, I think, but part of it was just what she stood for in terms of the system. So I think for me, what I'm the most concerned about is how we are really, a lot of our political action right now is motivated just by pure sort of visceral reaction to characters that we just find abhorrent, right? And so, and I'm not sure what that's going to do to us. On some level, I feel like it sort of sets us free because we're not going to be ever dependent on the office of presidency like we have ever again. But on other level, it just sort of leaves us adrift, morally adrift, and it disturbs me.
All right, so I want to ask you, especially given your pushback on being asked to give criticism of your own kind, I don't mind. No, I know you don't, because I first took note of you when you basically challenged Ben Shapiro, who's become a very popular voice in the kind of intellectual dark web, and you find his reasoning to be quite impressive at times, but find his style to sometimes get in the way. And I'd be curious to have you tell our audience kind of that experience of both your observations about him, your criticism of him, and then the response that it generated.
Yeah, so I think we live in a culture of argumentation now. We live in a very polemical sort of society. And success in politics seems to me to be defined increasingly as our ability to win an argument. And obviously there is a debate-oriented aspect to politics, and it is competitive. So there's a degree to which that's natural, but the larger project of politics should be to establish a sort of consensus that allows people to collaborate upon the formulating of and seeing the formulating of a particular solution, an answer to a problem or to a set of problems that is able to answer their own particular constituency's interests while also serving the broader interests of the greater society. But we've ceased to think in terms of there even being a possibility of our having win-win situations on a wide range of issues. And so the Ben Shapiro thing goes to your point about the whole 51% strategy towards getting elected. I imagine that if you go back in time a little bit to the days of Walter Cronkite and so forth, not to overly idealize the past, but I think it was possible in an era gone by for politicians, particularly running on the national level, to articulate a narrative about who and what America was that had some substantive resonance to more than just, you know, 50 or 40 or 35% of the population, whatever the base of their party might be. Any presidential candidate would have been happy to win with 51% of the vote or whatever percentage of the vote was necessary to win. But the difference today is that we tell stories about what America is or has become or was, that even as many of our leading political figures, to say nothing of pundits and so forth, sort of know even as they're articulating them, are only going to ring true to a fraction of American society, which means we've ceased to even think in terms of the American people as being a whole entity. Rather, we think in terms of who are the legitimate Americans, I suppose. Who are the Americans amongst us who are actually remaining true to American values, and who are the apostates that we would like to eliminate politically if we could? So the issue with Ben Shapiro was I wrote an article for a publication called called Quillette, where it was called, what did I name my own article? It was called the problem with facts, not feelings, because Ben Shapiro was famous for saying facts don't care about your feelings. That's sort of his mantra, and really that's sort of, that phrase encapsulates the political zeitgeist as I've known it for some time. And I just mentioned the fact that Ben Shapiro is a brilliant polemicist. He makes very effective debates, and he says a number of things that I agree with. But if his goal, if his objective is to be able to advance the cause of American civic society, then the only way we are going to accomplish that is if we highlight the common values that exist between the diverse constituencies of the American people. You can't do that by constantly focusing in on and berating and even insulting people's values who may have a different sort of perspective. So I contrasted his style with my own sort of style as a candidate for Congress, and a very different set of circumstances, of course. He's never been a political candidate, and I've never been a multimillionaire media figure, unfortunately. But, as an African-American Republican running in the hood, running in South Central, people would frequently ask me, and I recount in the article, you know, what was it like getting called an Uncle Tom all the time and a sellout and just getting all sorts of abuse from people for being a Republican. And I, you know, it's almost disappointing to have to tell people that that didn't really happen to me much at all, you know. And the reason for that is, on the one hand, you know, I tended to lead with my ideas. I didn't lead with, you know, partisan talking points. I didn't wave my Republican flag all over the place. But I recognized and empathized with the story, with the lived experience of the people amongst whom I was campaigning. I mean, there's a particular history to South Central Los Angeles and a particular cultural experience that the people who live in my community have been through, just as Tallahassee has its own history. And when I talked about various issues, I tried to frame it in terms of my own understanding of an experience with the African-American experience, with the urban experience. And if I was speaking to a group of people whose experiences I couldn't directly relate to biographically, I tried to demonstrate the fact that I had studied it and that I was seeking to understand, not just on an abstract intellectual level, but on an experiential level, what it is different constituencies in my district had gone through. And so by the time anybody came around to realizing that I was a Republican, which did happen, of course, some people were upset, but for the most part, people had already sort of learned to trust the fact that I meant what I said when I said that I was there to actually help people solve the real problems that were affecting their lives. Goes back to that old Jack Kemp saying. People don't care what you know until they know that you care. And that was basically the point I was trying to make to Ben Shapiro. And to his credit, he responded on Twitter and said that I'd made some good points and he'd keep moving in that direction. So hopefully he does. Yeah.
I was struck by his response mm-hmm. because it did seem heartfelt and it did seem as though some self-criticism from an ideological ally resonated and made it and kind of caused him to reflect and think. Steve, I know you've been following this intellectual dark web quite closely and have been kind of fascinated by the rise of these public intellectuals from across the political spectrum who are now writing and posting videos on the web to reach audiences that oftentimes have previously had no access to this. I want to get you to respond or react to something that I read in a favorite magazine of mine, The Atlantic. This is Caitlin Flanagan, a liberal writer for The Atlantic, who talked about how she came downstairs one day at her home and found her college-age son, a good progressive who supported Hillary, completely absorbed in following some of these videos of Ben and Jordan Peterson and others. And she then went on to kind of study this phenomenon and ended up writing an article called "Why is Jordan Peterson So Popular?" And one of the things that she says there is this. She says, "There are plenty of reasons for individual readers to dislike Jordan Peterson, but there's no coherent reason for the left's obliterating and irrational hatred of Jordan Peterson. What then accounts for it?" She says, "It is because the left, while it currently seems ascendant in our houses of culture and art, has in fact entered its decadent last phase and is deeply vulnerable. The left is not afraid of Peterson, but of the ideas that he promotes, which are completely inconsistent with identity politics of any kind." So I'm curious, do you find yourself agreeing with that observation? And do you think that this is part of the reason why the intellectual dark web has arisen, is because these are ideas that no one has engaged the way they once did on college campuses and things of that nature?
Well, that's a really interesting article. I read that when it came out, and I was really struck just by the human element of it. You've got a mother coming downstairs. She's got a son that she loves. This seemed like a sort of a traditional, well-off white family, Caucasian family. And so, she is, stands for principles from the left. She's sort of horrified by these new rationalists and sort of Jordan Peterson's particular sort of refusal to sort of accept gradations of oppression. Jordan Peterson says that we just live in a veil of tears and it's a world of pain and let's not even try to parse it out, right? It's hard for us all. And so, which, I take some exception to, and I know John does as well. But anyway, she's wrestling with her son being so fascinated and so drawn and so obviously fed in some way by this thinker. And if you think about it, this is a young man. He's a Generation Z, right? And so he has had the hell parented out of him. I mean, this is a kid who's had his parents sit across the table from him and just dote on his every word, right? He has been celebrated from the moment he could walk. His whole life has probably been captured in video. And now he's going into intellectual spaces. He's got a lot to say, right? And he's always been just celebrated for what he has to say. But he's going into intellectual spaces in more sophisticated high schools, and certainly when he hits college, particularly the Ivy League colleges he's going to go to, where he's going to be told in no uncertain terms to zip it. The most important thing for him to do is take up as little space as possible, and he's gonna be part of that group, right? He's gonna share the values of that group. He's a liberal young man, and he's gonna maybe he's gonna try to diminish his presence if possible, but it's not gonna feel good to him, right? Because he's a human being, he's a person, he's got some things to say. He's trying to grow as a young developing adult. And he's basically being deplatformed as a white male. So, and I'm not. It's complicated because I'm not saying that the message for him to zip it isn't a good message for him to hear, right? I'm not sure that that's not important for him to understand where that's coming from. But there's got to be a better way to help him negotiate that than to shut him down, right? There's got to be I think that there's got to be a way to invite those folks' voice into the conversation and still help them understand sort of the historic way in which they can bully those conversations. But, I mean, in Jordan Peterson, he has a complete champion. He's got someone telling him, take up your cross, pull your load, speak your truth, be courageous. And Jordan Peterson is saying enough that his mom and dad have said all those years that he sees in Jordan Peterson the chance to sort of reclaim his voice. And I think that's both a beautiful and a difficult place where we are right now, you know. And don't get me wrong, I think there is a lot that's really important and beautiful and necessary in what Jordan Peterson has to say. I just think that Jordan Peterson shoots himself in the foot by not acknowledging that we have groups in this country that do have more acute and chronic pain than others. I don't understand why it's so important for him to not fully reflect that.
Yeah. So we'll save the pros and cons of Peterson's philosophy for another discussion. But this was really interesting. The thing that I'm curious to kind of get your reaction to is, do you feel like the educational system is preparing young people, not just men? I mean, young people of all kinds, not just white men, young people of all kinds, for the kind of intellectual engagement that one finds in the intellectual dark web? Because there's a part of me that senses part of what is drawing people to this. It's like a almost kind of a new counterculture of sorts, where people are encountering ideas that they've never heard before, that in a bygone era would have been part of the normal discourse that would take place at a college campus, where you would be considering different points of view and you would be seeking to arrive at who has the best arguments. Whereas the impression I have is that a lot of young people are growing up without any exposure to a whole vast set of arguments and ideas. And when encountered with them, the way Caitlin describes it, that it has a natural fascination. So how much of what she's writing about and what you're seeing on college campuses is a reflection of that?
I'll let John take this, but I'll just say in short, yes, I do believe that that is a problem. I do believe that students aren't being really prepared. They're not having openness to those ideas modeled for them. And they're not encouraged necessarily to entertain the full spectrum of ideas, particularly about human nature and the nature of hierarchy, the nature of power, the nature of oppression. There's a really sort of a single story, I think, that's going on that the academy's pushing.
Yeah. You want to jump in on that?
Well, the question I hear you asking is, does the perceived shutting down of conversation on college campuses, is the perceived shutting down of conversation on college campuses open the door for the appeal of a person like Jordan Peterson? I definitely think that that's true. I wouldn't profess to have a great deal of firsthand insight into what happens in college campuses because I don't. I'm not an academic, and I was a pretty bad student also. So I probably should have been on campus more than I was. I do think, though, that, well, I do think that there's an issue on college campus just because